Democrats in the presidential race sticking around the Lone Star State to do something here they haven't in recent election cycles. Campaign. Some tips today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. Lots of change in Texas since the last time Democratic presidential candidates fought door-to-door for delegates. A primer on what not to take for granted from our own Joy Diaz. High tech to help schools track kids. And you've heard the expression, what a difference a day makes? Well, Saturday will mark one small leap for us all. How and why and a whole lot more on the national news show of You Know Where. And it all gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 27th day of February 2020. I'm David Brown. Happy Thursday, one and y'all. The largest U.S. maker of surgical masks faces a dilemma. Prestige Ameritech, which is based in Tarrant County, is getting so many orders from around the world it can't keep up. By now, I don't have to tell you why, surely. The president of Prestige Ameritech tells CBS DFW it's a madhouse at his North Richland Hills facility. We're going as fast as we can to fill orders, he says, churning out some 600,000 masks a day. The CEO says that if he cranked up the machines to run 24/7, he could make about 1 million masks a day, but that would be a drop in the bucket compared to global demand. His dilemma? He has about 100 workers. Does he hire more people to meet demand? If he does, what happens when that demand subsides, as it eventually will? Now, at last word, here in the U.S., there have been about 14 cases, including the first case of COVID-19, not linked to travel or to contact with someone known to have the virus, that case in California. The CDC has warned Americans to be prepared for the spread here in the U.S. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie has been asking if San Antonio is ready.
Mayor Rod Nirenberg says yes.
We are as prepared a city in the nation based on our teamwork with STRAC.
What's STRAC? Well, STRAC is the Southwest Regional Advisory Council, which has a pretty specific focus.
So trauma patients, if you're in a car wreck or shot or fall out of a tree, cardiac patients, if you have a heart attack, stroke patients, and, you know, the regular emergency healthcare system.
STRAC Executive Director Eric Epley says the agency does that for a 22-county area of South Texas. It's a region the size of West Virginia, and over the years, it's gotten pretty good at emergencies.
And so one of our other jobs is to manage the disaster response for healthcare.
There are 74 hospitals in STRAC's network. It also oversees emergency response plans for air medical providers and more than 70 EMS agencies. Epley says it drills various agencies on disaster preparedness, including infectious diseases.
We'll bring the hazmat guys, we'll bring our medical special operations unit from the fire department and work directly with their preparedness staff and the emergency department staff and walk through literally step by step by step in slow motion. A little bit like a football team, you run the play slowly and then speed up and speed up.
It was STRAC that called on Methodist Hospital Texan in San Antonio to care for the first case of COVID-19 in the city. It was an evacuee from Wuhan, China, who had been quarantined at Joint Base San Antonio, Lackland. Methodist Chief Medical Officer Paul Hancock says Methodist Texan was and remains ready for patients who need specialized care for infectious diseases.
We have isolation rooms that are available. We have the personalized protective equipment that is necessary, and we have staff that are familiar in the use of the personalized protective equipment.
And there's a strict protocol for putting that gear on and taking it off.
We call that donning and doffing the equipment. And not only do we follow this process very closely, we have another staff member observing the caregiver putting on and also observing the caregiver removing the equipment.
STRAC's Eric Epley says RMOC, the Regional Medical Operations Center, has been partially activated throughout the COVID-19 quarantine at Lackland.
And the RMOC is where hospitals, public health, our EMS colleagues, our air medical colleagues, Bexar County Medical Society, the UT Health Science Center, all of those people come together physically in one place.
STRAC activates RMOC during disasters that require an emergency medical response.
And it's worked well for us for the last 15, 20 years with hurricanes, but it also worked well in H1N1. It worked well during Ebola, and it's working really well for COVID-19.
And that's the thing about disasters. They happen. And infectious diseases, they happen too. They always have. Dr. Hancock at Methodist Hospital System says they always will.
And hopefully this one will pass soon, but next year or the next year or the next year, there'll probably be something else, and we'll be prepared for that as well.
Worldwide, more than 82,000 people have been infected with COVID-19. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
All this week, we've been considering some of the substantive issues one by one as voters in Texas cast their ballots. When it comes to the issue of immigration policy, as you're probably aware, there have been quite a few changes since 2016. The question is whether and if so, to what extent immigration will be a factor in the Texas primaries and ultimately come November. Victoria DeFrancesco Soto is the Assistant Dean for Civic Engagement and lecturer at the University of Texas at Austin's LBJ School of Public Affairs, and she is in transit at the moment. Professor, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear. Thank you, David.
Thank you so much for taking a few minutes out to speak with us on your very busy day. Perhaps we should sort of summarize how much immigration law has changed in these 4 years. Been quite a few changes, but I guess most noteworthy is what's happened to asylum seekers, right?
So we've seen a number of procedures and laws change with regards to asylum and refugee seekers. We've also seen just kind of immigration rules change as a result of several executive orders that President Trump put into place soon after he came into office, mm-hmm. otherwise known as the Muslim ban, which took a while to go into effect because of court issues. We also see the construction of the wall, more money going to our southern border to put up that wall. So we've seen immigration changes in all shapes and sizes, from changes in terms of who can receive benefits of those who are our permanent residents here, the green card holders, to the changes that we saw a couple summers ago where we were separating families. So it runs the gamut. Long story short, a ton of changes when it comes to immigration.
Indeed.
In a relatively short time.
But, you know, here's the thing. Do you think that this is something that people are even remembering or that they're aware of right now? Because it hasn't come up extensively in the presidential debates.
It hasn't. And so much has happened with regards to immigration that it really has become a blur. I think, though, that when we talk about immigration, we talk about the folks who are most affected, and those are immigrants themselves, the families of immigrants. So immigration is a very important topic for the immigration community. But beyond that, immigrant communities also care about the same things that non-immigrant communities care about. They care about healthcare, they care about education, they care about income inequality. So immigration by itself, aside from those flashpoints of family separation at the border and the protests at the airport, really tends to fade back to the issues that affect us day to day, namely, you know, can we find a doctor that will treat us? Can mm-hmm. we send our kids to schools that we're happy with?
I want to ask you about among the Democrats who remain in the race. Are there any who seem to be embracing immigration as an issue? I know Julian Castro made this a fixture in his platform, but it didn't seem to get embraced by a lot of folks on the campaign trail. So how do you, as you look at the Democrats who are still in the race, does anyone stand out?
I think the only one who stands out to me for not being proactive in her stance on immigration is Amy Klobuchar. And ironically, she was there working on the Gang of Eight bills. She has been in Congress and helping to try to get some type of comprehensive immigration reform passed, but she hasn't proactively spoken about it, such as, for example, Biden has, Julian did when he was in the race, Bloomberg most recently when he went to El Paso. Aside from that, though, I don't see a whole lot of difference. Everybody is for stopping child separation. Everybody is for kind of stopping these draconian immigration policies that President Trump has put into place. So I don't see a whole lot of difference. I think it's more of a matter of who is branding themselves as the more immigration owning candidate.
The Latino electorate is far more diverse than being focused like a laser beam on the issue of immigration. But I wonder to what extent it still remains a kind of proxy for trying to reach out to the Latino vote.
Oh, David, this is a complicated one, mainly because of the diversity of the Latino population, because you have folks who, you know, crossed the border and are immigrants from a week ago. Then you have folks who the border crossed them or their ancestors have been here for eight generations. So, yes, they are technically of Latin American immigrant descent, but it's so far removed, so it's not important to them as opposed to someone who may be undocumented or who may have undocumented family members. Where immigration plays a very interesting role in politics is the tenor of it. If you have somebody saying really, really ugly things about Latinos or Latino immigrants, when people are calling you criminals and rapists and drug dealers, that hits and that can have a potential political impact aside from the substance of policy.
So then let me ask you, come November, how much of a liability do you think that's going to be for President Trump, who, as you quoted there, has a record, a history of saying things that are inflammatory when it comes to migrants and people trying to get into the United States?
So I think that we're going to see immigration flare back up because this is an issue that plays well with his base. It's probably still going to frustrate some of those moderate Republicans who held their nose and voted for him. And, you know, I doubt we're going to see any new crossover voters because of that. I think the people who voted for Trump because of immigration are going to stick with him. And the people who run away from Trump because of immigration are going to keep running.
Boy, it's going to be a very interesting Super Tuesday, to say nothing of November.
Yes.
And Victoria DeFrancesco Soto is going to be following it. You can bet on that. She's Assistant Dean for Civic Engagement and lecturer at the University of Texas at Austin's LBJ School of Public Affairs. Professor, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on The Standard.
My pleasure.
Just in time to tell us what Texans are talking about, our social media editor, Wells Dunbar.
Hi, David. While echoing what we just discussed, we're hearing which immigration issues are weighing on voters as they head to the polls. On our Facebook page, Morgan Hamilton says, I think the number one issue is reinstating DACA without burdensome restrictions that make it nearly impossible to use. These dreamers think of themselves as Americans because they were raised here, so let's make them actual citizens. Overall, she says, our current immigration system must be overhauled so that it is streamlined and less burdensome to all parties. That's just some of the news our friends and listeners are sounding off about. I'll be back with more later in the show. No shortage of stuff to talk about today, David.
No, indeed. Let us hear from you. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar is looking for you. And he's going to be back here in about 35 minutes or so with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Galveston Island, celebrating spring break with golf beaches, seafood, and family-friendly attractions, including Moody Gardens, dolphin watching adventures, and more. Details at galveston.com.
Hey, it's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Young people want cool gadgets and clothes, but you got to spend money for those, and not many people have learned how to save first. I'm talking about young people here. As KERA's Stella Chavez reports, some Dallas high school students aren't just learning how to budget. They're going beyond the gadgets and learning why money management really matters.
All right. Welcome, everyone.
On this Friday morning, 120 students from Thomas Jefferson High School in Dallas are talking money.
So we'll begin with a small introduction. Your name and what do you want to buy for yourself, okay?
The 11th and 12th graders aren't shy about what's on their wish list.
My name is Catherine and I want to buy a new house.
My name is Okeli and I'd like to buy a Tesla Model S.
Wow!
This is the school's fourth year participating in the Master Leadership Conference at Fidelity Investments' Westlake campus. This year, it all takes on greater meaning. The school was devastated by an EF3 tornado in October, so students have been temporarily moved to Edison Middle School. The district plans to renovate Jefferson for about $82 million. helping students understand major costs and emergencies is crucial. And after the leadership conference, they'll take a pretty big assignment back with them.
That not only are you going to be trained, but the challenge is you're going to go back to school and you're going to train your peers and your families.
That's Vice Principal Evelyn Perrette. Jefferson has a large population of English language learners. About half of incoming ninth graders have been in the country a year or less. Most of the students are from Mexico and Central America. According to a 2016 National Financial Capability Study, only 27% of young adults understand basic financial concepts like interest rates and inflation. That's a big reason the school has returned to this training the past few years.
We really want to stress that finance is very important. It's a really important aspect of everybody's life. If you manage your finance well, pretty much everything else, you know, comes with it.
That's Elizar Alvalos, an analyst with Fidelity, who actually graduated from Jefferson in 1997. When he started high school, he had just moved to the U.S. He didn't know any English and says that experience helps him relate to the students in this training. Students like Flor Gonzalez.
Everybody thinks like the present, not the future. I think it's important because we need to think about the future, like college. If you want to go to college, like have a money to be like independent.
Flor told her fellow classmates about the time she saved up hundreds of dollars only to misplace it all, a story she hopes will teach her friends a valuable lesson.
I think it's important because you need to know how to manage your money, but responsible, not like me that I lose my money. So this is very important because I really need the money that I lost.
For professionals in finance, teaching kids these life skills is rewarding. Jennifer Gray is Senior Manager of Community Relations at Fidelity.
A strong foundation of financial education is important for all students to be successful. And it is something that our employees are passionate about. So to have the opportunity to go in and share what they know with the students is really meaningful for us.
And when students eventually teach their peers what they've learned, that's meaningful too. I'm Stella Chavez in Westlake.
Support for Coverage of Business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Well, if you have children of phone-carrying age, you may use software to keep tabs on your kids, you know, to find them in an emergency or maybe to make sure they're not going places you don't want them to go. But new technology is allowing schools to track your kids, too. Developers of the tool say it could prevent school shootings by ensuring that only authorized people are on campus. But could constant surveillance of our kids perhaps do more harm than good? Tech expert Omar Gayaga is here to tell us about this new software and why parents might want to ask some questions at school. Omar, I'm not familiar with this particular technology. I have to be honest. I know that like laptops and stuff are generally tracked by schools because it's, you know, it's a capital asset. But what is this that we're talking about here?
Yeah, this springs from a CNET story that we saw about a company called Inpixon. They're based out of Palo Alto. They're a Silicon Valley company.
Yep.
And to be upfront, we're not aware of any Texas schools that are using this yet, but there are 10 schools across the country, and they're looking at going international with this. And this is an RF scanning piece of software. What it does is it tracks cell phones that might, you know, your kid might be carrying through their Bluetooth, through their Wi-Fi, their cell signal, and can position them within 1 meter of accuracy in the building. So they could tell exactly where the kid is at any particular point in time. But also, this is part of a whole wave of kind of surveillance and tracking software that is being employed in some schools. Also, facial recognition is one that you know, we've been looking at quite a bit.
Right.
Even social media. I had a company pitch me a few years ago about being able to track students' social media behavior and their school behavior and red flag students and say, this kid might be a problem, you know, you might want to take them aside and do something.
It's very interesting because I can see how people can have different levels of comfort when it comes to something like, say, tracking social media. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of parents who would like some assistance on that front. You know, I mean, so how is it or why is it that this tracking software has become controversial to at least to some extent?
Well, for one thing, I mean, the idea of that your kid is being tracked all day, anywhere
but
where they are.
But at school?
At school, but it's also through their own devices. It's not you know, the laptop that the school gives you or the iPad. It's their own devices from home. Uh-huh. And they can also blacklist people, you know, through a MAC address from, you know, alerting the school to someone's presence that shouldn't be there. But the idea is, you know, is that healthy for your kid to be tracked all the time? Is it healthy for them to be aware that they're being tracked all the time? Does that change their behavior, change their self-consciousness? There hasn't been a lot of study of what that does in the long term.
Is it true that it's possible for schools to track kids who are too young to carry a cell phone?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this technology could easily be tracked through an ID badge. You know, one of my elementary school kids has an ID badge that they carry around every day.
Sure.
A wristband, you know, for younger kids. I mean, this is technology that all it requires is really a sensor.
I'm curious about this, though. The developers say that this could prevent school shootings by making sure that only authorized people are on campus. How so? I don't understand that.
That if there was, say, a person that you knew was a, you know, was an issue, or a parent that you don't want anywhere near campus, it could detect when their device is nearby.
I see.
Of course, you're assuming that they're carrying the device on them, you know, when
you'd have to know who that person was, though, to have that identified.
It would
right?
have to, they would have to have the MAC address or some sort of way of tracking
some
that
sort
device.
Of way. Okay. So I would assume that the reason that schools want this tech is all about safety.
It is, but then there's also the idea of, like, well, what else, what other ways are they using this information? And there's some ways that might be benign, like attendance. You know, you want to know if your kid attended to class or if they were at, you know, where they said they were going to be at this mm-hmm, time. Mm-hmm. But there's also the idea of, you know, this is the same kind of technology that's used in malls, that's used in prisons, you know, to try and attract people. And in retail, we're seeing it used to you know, to market to people. We're seeing it used to see where people are in the store and where they're shopping and what products they like. You know, could some of that data be used in some other ways through schools?
So could parents opt out of this?
It really depends on the school district and who's using it. That's not up to the company to decide. But there was a controversy here about 8 years ago in San Antonio with ID badges that mm-hmm, were using mm-hmm. tracking, and that created a huge furor, but I believe it still went forward.
Of course, this latest technology hasn't quite made its way to Texas just yet, but watch this space. We'll have to see how this develops.
There's lots of ways to track kids.
Omar Gayaga talks about all things tech over at techminutetexas.com, and he'll be keeping up with this and many other stories over there. Omar, good to see you again, sir. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for having me, David.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. A Texas congressman says he voted against a bill that would make lynching a federal hate crime because the punishment associated with it was too lenient. East Texas Republican Louis Gohmert was one of four U.S. House members to oppose the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act. Following Wednesday's vote, Gohmert said the bill's maximum 10-year prison sentence is not enough.
And I would much rather, if somebody is lynched in Texas, they be subject under Texas law to the death penalty rather than a 10-year maximum. It sends entirely the wrong message about how serious this is.
The legislation now returns to the U.S. Senate for a vote, which passed another version of the bill last year. U.S. Senator John Cornyn of Texas says officials on the national and local levels are doing all they can to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. The Republican told reporters yesterday Congress wants to go beyond the Trump administration's funding request of $2.5 billion.
We are in the process of considering an emergency request for as much as $8 billion in additional money to be spending on this outbreak.
Governor Greg Abbott is meeting with public health officials today and plans to outline steps the state will take should the coronavirus spread to Texas. A campaign rally is getting underway in Houston for former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who's once again visiting Texas ahead of the March 3rd primary election. But as Houston Public Media's Sasha Cordner reports, he's not the only Democratic presidential candidate stopping in the state over the next few days.
Senator Elizabeth Warren will also be in Texas later today. She's holding a town hall in San Antonio at around 6:30 this evening. Warren will be joined by former Democratic presidential candidate and former San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro at the Sunset Station Lone Star Pavilion. She'll also be in Houston for a town hall Saturday. Meanwhile, former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg will be in Dallas Sunday for a rally as well.
Also, Tom Steyer plans to host a town hall in Houston Saturday, and former Vice President Joe Biden will campaign in Houston and Dallas Monday. Four El Paso groups are teaming up to create a new piece of music to honor the victims of the Walmart shooting. The El Paso Times reports the collaboration unites the El Paso Symphony Orchestra, the El Paso Opera, El Paso Pro Musica, and the University of Texas at El Paso Music Department. I'm Joseph Leahy.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from UT Austin's Value Institute for Health and Care, now offering two-day executive education programs for health professionals who want to lead value-based care transformations. Learn more at utvalueinstitute.org.
Hey, it's David Brown, and you're on Texas Standard Time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Oh, wait. That's not always the case. 2020 actually has 366 days, and this week we're getting a visit from our old friend February 29th. It's all because Earth's trip around the sun actually takes a little bit more than 365 days. Truth be told, it takes 365.2422 days to be exact, and, believe it or not, the leap year capital of the world is right here in the Lone Star State, Anthony, Texas. The city hosts a four-day festival to celebrate the extra day. Here to explain why we do all this stuff is Dr. Kevin Christunas. He is associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Texas A&M. Professor, welcome to Texas Standard.
Thank you.
What's the point of leap years, and are they really that important?
If you want the calendar to be in sync with the orbit of the Earth, you do. If you want to celebrate Easter on the right Sunday of the year, then you have to account for this.
Well, when did we start doing this? Was Easter involved here or what?
In the last couple years of the reign of Julius Caesar, on advice of his astronomers, they explained to him that the year isn't 365 days. It is closer to 365 and a quarter. Mm-hmm. And so Julius Caesar issued an edict and he said, okay, every 4 years forever will be a leap year. So we'll have 366 days. And so that's the way things went for about 1,600 years. But astronomers figured out that the year isn't exactly 365 and a quarter. And so they came up with a new rule that the century years like 1700, 1800, and 1900 would not be leap years, but the century years like 1600, 2000, 2400, they would be leap years.
Wow, but that's a whole lot of stuff to try to cram together here. I mean, a whole lot of concepts, because you're trying to rationalize many different things at once. I suppose what you're suggesting is why we have leap years every 4 years and not every, say, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, right?
Right, because the simplest way to do it is just to leave out three of them every century. And that works okay for a while. Instead of 970 leap years every 4,000 years, there's actually about 969. So somewhere down the line, about 2,000 years from now, we should not take a leap year when we might.
Tell me you're not doing this math in your head. Do you just memorize all these figures? How do you know this stuff?
Well, I've taught about 4,500 astronomy students here at Texas A&M in the last 13 years.
That'll do it.
And so some things that I've mentioned, they've been part of a lecture on 60 occasions. So there are various things, you know, at my fingertips.
That's amazing. What would happen, Professor, if we just stopped having a February 29th every 4 years?
Ah, well, then the calendar would get more and more out of sync with the sky. For example, when they did the calendar reform in 1582, they simply declared for Catholic countries that the day after October 4th, 1582, was going to be October 15th. And in Protestant countries, they said, heck no, we don't have to do something just because the Pope says it.
Oh,
that's why we had the Reformation.
Uh-huh.
But eventually in England, they made the switch in 1752, and eventually Russia made it in 1918. And the very last country to go over to the Gregorian calendar was Greece in 1923.
1923, that's pretty amazing.
But you may know that the Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, celebrate Easter and Christmas on the old calendar, the Julian calendar, mm-hmm. not the Gregorian
right.
calendar.
Right, right. Professor, can you think of a better way to do this? Is this the most efficient way to deal with this offset?
Well, you know, what is a day? A day is how long it takes the Earth to spin, and what is a year? How long it takes to go around its orbit. There's no reason to think that there should be an exact even number of days in a year. In fact, no planet in our solar system has a year that's an integral number of its days.
It's just something that we feel like we need to have here on planet Earth.
Well, in order to have an accurate calendar, you have to factor all this in.
Dr. Kevin Christunis is associate professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at Texas A&M. He knows this stuff inside and out. Professor, thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on the Texas Standard, and happy leap year.
Thank you. Nice talking to you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where horned frogs strive to be responsible world citizens. More on how a trip to Norway challenged students' perspectives on mass incarceration and justice at tcu.edu/stories.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm Marika Flatt, travel editor with Texas Lifestyle Magazine, here with your weekend trip tip. As Texas's biggest city, Houston offers a lot when it comes to dining and accommodations. From intimate boutique establishments to luxurious resorts, Houston has something for everyone. And if you're time-starved, here are some suggestions for 24 hours in H-Town. Situated on 10 oak-studded acres, just west of downtown, the Post Oak Hotel is Houston's premier five-star hotel. Created by Houston Rockets owner Tillman Fertitta, the 38-story tower boasts lavish accommodations and a design that will make you say, wow, around every corner. There's a sparkling chandelier in the center of the guest bathrooms and a flat-screen TV at the foot of the soaking tubs. The rooms have electric curtains and an intricate lighting system. Besides being just a hotel, the Post Oak features a two-level Rolls-Royce Bentley dealership and offers four restaurants. But the centerpiece of the property is the Post Oak Hotel's pool located on a luxurious terrace. A visit to any Texas city isn't complete without a meal at a Mexican restaurant. Blanco Tacos and Tequila is the go-to place in Houston's Galleria for delicious Tex-Mex paired with handcrafted margaritas. Blanco's menu is huge, and you really can't go wrong with any of their signature dishes. But we recommend starting with the hamachi and watermelon ceviche and the grilled Mexican street corn. Our favorite main dish is the crispy fried shrimp tacos, which combine pickled onions with a tangy guacamole sauce. For one of the best brunches in Houston, we recommend making a visit to Café Poets. It's an elegant Parisian restaurant that serves up traditional French cuisine. During the week, Café Poets is the go-to place for coffees and light bites with friends. The cafe is also open for dinner Thursday through Saturday, offering a delicious assortment of handcrafted French dishes that you won't find anywhere else in Houston. The restaurant's signature dish is the coquette, which is a traditional French casserole dish meant for sharing with family and friends. Ingredients for the dish are sourced from the restaurant's garden and local farmers, making for a uniquely fresh dining experience. The French dishes are upstaged only by the adorable furnishings that have an Alice in Wonderland feel. That's your weekend trip tip. I'm Marika Flatt for the Texas Standard.
Marika Flatt is travel editor for Texas Lifestyle Magazine. You can find more of her weekend trip tips at texasstandard.org. The days when Democratic presidential hopefuls would think of Texas primarily as their ATM machine, hitting up donors for cash and then disappearing to campaign in other states, those days are gone.
Texas is a very different place than it was 20 years ago. Demographically, the state is close to 40% Hispanic and more than 5% Asian. As Democratic presidential candidates get back to the business of retail politics in Texas, you know, shaking hands, knocking on doors, trying to win some of the 261 delegates Texas has up for grabs this Super Tuesday, the Standard's Joy Diaz thought that perhaps they could benefit from a refresher so as not to trip over any lingering stereotypes.
If you want to know Texas politics, political consultant Matthew Dowd is a good person to talk to.
I've worked on campaigns on both sides of the aisle, many in Texas and many else around the country.
He's worked for governors, presidents. You get the idea.
When I was 12 years old, I watched Watergate hearings, and I got fascinated by it and entranced by it. And so I said, that's what I want to do in some way. I want to get involved in politics.
He's done it ever since, and he's seen lots of fast change happen in Texas over the last four decades.
How fast this is changing? The campaign that you ran 10 years ago is no longer valid in what you need to do today.
So, number one, candidates hoping to win Texas will need a crash course in Hispanic and Latinx voters.
Just because you can pronounce fajita doesn't mean you have some connection to the Latino community or Latina community here.
So please, don't make any rookie mistakes. For instance, a lot of political rallies in Texas play mariachi music. Nothing wrong with that. But keep in mind, mariachis are originally from Mexico, and the community's heritage hails from all over the globe, from 20-plus Spanish-speaking countries located in places as different as Africa, Europe, and the Americas. Dowd likes to remind candidates Latinx and Hispanic voters are very diverse.
Geographically, demographically, and generationally.
So meet voters where they are. Make an effort. Work it.
You can't just say, I put a website together and then somebody comes in, you know, months later and says, maybe we ought to translate it into Spanish.
The message to candidates is, don't be afraid to learn more. Now that candidates know about Hispanic and Latinx voters, let's focus our attention on another fast-growing group in Texas. In fact, the fastest-growing demographic, Asian Americans. That community has grown by 42% since 2010. Today, every major city in Texas hosts Lunar New Year celebrations, like this one in Houston. Just a few weeks ago, dancers dressed as Chinese dragons entertained a large crowd there. From my view in Austin, I've seen more Asian American students at my son's elementary school each year. I talked to some of their parents as we waited for school to end the other day about the issues that matter to them. Rika Joshi from India says her main issue is healthcare.
I mean, I have two kids, and they do fall sick, and so many of us have old parents. It's important to take care of your family too, and that's, I think, getting harder by the day.
Another mom, who didn't want to be named, talked about how fears of the coronavirus are reigniting racism against Asian Americans. At the University of Texas, I met V. No. She's a pediatrician and an artist, and she is of Vietnamese heritage.
Personally, you know, immigration, refugees, yes, this is a topic that's important to us, but also a lot of things that are misconceptions of the Asian community is that, you know, poverty doesn't relate to us. And there's a huge rate of poverty amongst Asian communities all across the nation. What's happening in this country in regards to acceptance of refugees? Of course, it's a very strong voice in my decisions for candidates, but it's not the only one.
Karthik Ramakrishnan says this diversity of issues,
including gun control, including environmental protection,
shouldn't surprise candidates. He teaches political science and public policy at the University of California, Riverside. This year, he cites the candidacy of Andrew Yang, the first Asian American to run for president on the Democratic side, as a challenge to the old stereotype that Asian Americans are the silent demographic.
Andrew Yang's candidacy was refreshing in a lot of ways because he was running on an issue that most people would not identify as an Asian American issue or even a minority issue. The threat of automation and the solution was universal basic income. That was a new look that we had not seen before among minority candidates or candidates of color.
Yeah. Big picture, color is what candidates will find in the Texas of 2020. So, come prepared, because Texas politics are no longer just in black and white. In Austin, I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Well, look at that. We're almost nearing the end of the big broadcast, but of course we've got enough time to talk about an important race up in North Texas that may be a kind of game changer, and we'll be checking in with our social media editor to hear more of the talk of Texas. That's all ahead as the Standard continues.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. As we near Super Tuesday, we're taking a closer look at some of the more closely watched, politically telling races coming up, one of which is in Texas's 24th Congressional District. It includes parts of Dallas and Tarrant counties, in areas considered among the most politically combustible this election cycle. Yes, we're talking about the suburbs. The 24th is wide open after a longtime Republican incumbent chose not to seek re-election, and as KERA's Saida Hassan reports, six Democrats stand ready to flip the district from red to blue if they can.
On a rainy Tuesday night, voters from across North Texas file into the Irving Arts Center to hear from candidates in the race for Texas's 24th congressional district. Farmers Branch resident Barb Currier is a regular voter in local and national elections. She's been studying the candidates' platforms and isn't sure who she's backing just yet. But Currier says she'll support the Democratic candidate in the general election.
There's a lot of similarity, and I am on board on all of them. Health care, doing something about the guns, doing something about education, the environment, all of those issues, they're huge.
After years of Republican leadership, Texas's 24th congressional district has emerged as a key battleground in the 2020 election. The district runs from Fort Worth to Dallas, spanning several smaller cities and northern suburbs. Last year, incumbent Republican Kenny Marchant announced he would not seek re-election. Marchant did win the election in 2018, but by a shrinking margin. Now, North Texas Democrats see an opportunity to flip this historically red district. At this Democratic primary debate, six candidates take the stage. Candidate Kim Olson is a retired Air Force colonel and a top fundraiser in this race. Her campaign has now raised more than $1 million.
Do not think for a minute the Republicans are going to give up this district easily. They are going to fight us tooth and nail. And we have to have record turnout vote if we want to take this district. And that's what it takes to get this done.
Candidate Jan McDowell is a familiar face in the district. She was the Democratic nominee in both 2016 and 2018, ultimately losing both races to Kenny Marchant. McDowell says she understands complex financial issues. She says she might be the most progressive candidate in this field, but knows how to appeal to moderates.
I feel like I am the candidate of the working people in the district, who want to have a voice in Washington who reflects their lives and experiences.
Meanwhile, former art director Sam Vega says he's the most progressive candidate in this race. Vega calls himself a Democratic socialist and says he'll fight for policies like Medicare for All and the Green New Deal, even if they don't have bipartisan support.
It is so obvious to so many people that things need to change, that the current system isn't working for everyone.
Candidate John Began is taking a different approach. Referencing his training as a neuroscientist, Began says he would make policy decisions rooted in evidence.
I don't worry about whether or not something is a Democratic idea or a Republican idea. I just want the best one. And if you can show me the evidence, I will gladly follow along.
Candidate Candace Valenzuela has served on the school board for the Carrollton Farmers Branch District. She's confident she can win over young people and swing voters. Valenzuela has earned endorsements from high-profile Democrats, including Senator Elizabeth Warren.
My campaign is rooted in my community and my love for it. And voters can tell that about me when I talk to them, when I talk about the coalitions I've built and the people I've reached and the policies that I've pushed forth in the school board.
candidate Richard Fleming served on the same school board as Valenzuela. Fleming says it's important for voters to think about electability. He says the winner of this race will likely face off against Republican Beth Van Dyne. Van Dyne is a former mayor of Irving who has earned an endorsement from President Donald Trump. She's widely seen as the Republican frontrunner in this race.
And I got a similar profile as her. I'm a business owner. I'm a family man. I'm a man of faith. And so I think I got the best resume. And we have to send somebody that's going to be able to match her resume for resume.
With such a large field of candidates, a runoff election in May is likely. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Joining us once again in this, and I was about to say in our social media studio.
Hey,
that would
man.
Be kind
Works
of an interesting
me.
Idea. Here's our social media editor, Wells Dunbar. Yeah, I bet. That'd be kind of cool,
I
wouldn't
dig
it?
It, man.
Little lights and buttons and whistles going on.
Yeah, studio of the future today. Well, you know, fascinating report there about the congressional race in North Texas. Election talk everywhere. And speaking of elections, believe it or not, in these polarized times, there's such a thing as an undecided voter. We learned this when we put out a call on Twitter and Facebook for those rare creatures, undecided voters, as part of an election night special we have in the works for Super Tuesday. And we got dozens of responses, folks still undecided for a bevy of reasons. But we're opening this up again. If someone you know is undecided, maybe you yourself, drop us a line at texasstandard@kut.org, or you can just reach out on Twitter or Facebook so a producer can get in
touch.
Really
with think
you.
There's someone out there undecided?
Believe it or not, I've seen them.
We got like
40 responses on a Facebook thread
right.
about this. It's kind of crazy. Right. Although people do have different reasons. You know, it's you would think that things are polarized and people would know who they want, but you know, lots of factors at play. So interesting discussion. We're going to continue on the show leading up to Election Day there. Well, discussion about the coronavirus everywhere, fear about the spread of the virus, jitters over its economic impact, sending the stock market into correction territory. Don't know if you've seen the latest numbers there.
Yes,
still
indeed.
About 10% down. Many of
is
our friends.
Is it really 10% down?
Not today, but overall.
Okay,
rather,
yeah,
I should say, since the start of the week.
That's in correction territory
exactly.
right there. Yeah.
Many of our friends and listeners on social media concerned about the Trump administration response to what could become a full-bore health crisis. In that press conference yesterday, lots of discussion about this. Donald Trump made waves naming Vice President Mike Pence a coronavirus czar of sorts, if you will. Move that's prompted lots of reaction online. Lydia Galvan says, too bad the administration cut CDC funding, Centers for Disease Control, and the center's whole pandemic response team, referring there to a disbanding of a previous pandemic team under the leadership of then Security Advisor John Bolton. Pence is not going to be able to take the place of that, Lydia continues. You need medical people and systems in place long before an emergency situation.
I think John Bolton is rather gone,
yeah,
though.
He's gone.
He's in the rearview mirror, as they say.
Yeah. I know, it's hard to keep track. Bill Gross says, the appointment actually makes sense. The impact of a pandemic in the U.S., if the worst case develops, will require more than just a medical response. Bill notes that functions of local, state, and federal governments could be impacted. Everyone thinks of the need to protect first responders in these situations, but ignores the fact many in government service have a far greater impact, the sort of people that basically keep the lights on, the water flowing, and all that good stuff.
Okay.
Another interesting perspective, several folks pointing out, or noting, rather, this HIV outbreak in Indiana while Pence was governor there that was apparently exacerbated by a lack of testing and Pence's refusal for these needle exchange sites. This is a sort of opiate crisis-fueled HIV outbreak in Indiana. So raising some questions whether or not Pence is the right person for this job.
I seem to recall, well, I'm not even going to go there. No, because I hear the music and I know what's going
to
happen. But we'd love to hear your comments, Texas. You know what to do. Just look for Texas Standard on social media. Wells Dunbar is always looking for you as our social media editor. And, of course, you can keep up with the news over at texasstandard.org. We're going to be back here on the wireless set, and we hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown. That's tomorrow, by the way. Till then, I'm David Brown. Have a terrific Thursday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and the Cynthia and George Mitchell Foundation.